Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. We have on with us today, again, our special guest, Frans Dell, former warden of 27 years from Amsterdam. Frans has been involved in many different areas of universal needs and concerns and issues. And he recently came back from Ukraine, so he's going to be speaking on several different issues today. And I'd like the audience to call in, listen in, or if you want to participate, come on board. But right now, again, we are going to introduce our special guest, very unique because he has been involved with the United Nations, with the Global Initiative on Psychiatry, the Marine and Council of Europe, and so many other areas that we have been discussing over the news and also our concerns about what goes on in these specific countries, our country and other countries surrounding. So again, we're going to be introducing Frans Dell of Amsterdam. Frans, are you on with us?
Yes, I am, Leona. And
I want to once again welcome you.
I'm very honored to be a guest again. Thank you.
Thank you. So would you please introduce yourself again to the audience and for those who haven't listened or heard from you before, if you can just tell a little bit about yourself. And then I understand you recently came back from Ukraine, so maybe if you can update us on some of those issues as well.
Very, very good, because I think there are some things in Ukraine that we are working on, which also go for a lot of incarcerated people in the United States. So especially the subject of PTSS can be recognized by a lot of listeners, I think.
Okay.
Well, I'm Frans Dow. I started working with juveniles when I was 20. I worked in forensic psychiatry and became warden of several prisons in the Netherlands. I did that for 28 years. All kinds of different prisons, female, open, half open, prisons for life sentence prisoners, which is a life sentence in the Netherlands still. Female, short sentence prisoners, all kinds of prisons. And several years, the beginning of the end of the 90s, 1998, I started working in knowledge exchange projects all over the world. I was then director of warden of the forensic psychiatric facility of the Dutch prison system. So I started to be involved in knowledge exchange projects with Russia, Lithuania, other Eastern European countries, England, the Caribbean, all kinds of different places. And I did that until today. And another interesting thing probably to tell about myself is that I was always fascinated and very occupied with trying to find a way to stop the violence, you know. How do we do that? So about 14 years ago, I founded a foundation, Recovery and Return, together with Toon Walraven, who is a former incarcerated guy. And we bring all parties involved in the whole process of crime, punishment, recovery and return. We bring those people together, and we will have our next meeting day on October 6th in Eindhoven, and then we will have all those about 150 people there meeting each other. So that's an important thing we did. I wrote a book. I'm a lot in the publicity in the Netherlands. I'm a little bit all over the place here in the Netherlands, which is, I must admit, a very small country comparing to the big and the huge United States. And that's me. Thank you, Leona. That's my introduction.
I was going to ask, where you've been involved in so many different organizations and all around the world, you must be subjected at times to a lot of controversial issues because of the division that we have worldwide now. So when you meet with some of these people, or when you go to some of these countries and you see what's going on in these countries, you see injustices, even in the United States, injustices in the prison system. You see injustices in the community around the world. So do you, when you see these things and you form your judgments, or you form your opinions or ideas from what is going on in these countries, what kind of solutions would you recommend in a lot of these areas?
Well, it starts a little bit with how I want to look into the world. It starts with my own square meter. So I want to look to countries, to the situation in countries, with an open view. I don't want to judge what people do. Well, I don't want to judge people. I can sometimes judge the acts of people. So I try to be as open as possible, and I try to communicate with people that for me, everybody counts, and everybody can be the person who he is, and that I'm interested in who he or she is. That's a good start, I think, in going into a country or in a situation or a prison or a forensic psychiatric hospital. It starts with your own respect for human dignity, I think. And when people see that, immediately the reaction is different, and you can connect, and people you are trusted. I think that's a very important thing. So when I am in Ukraine, I can give you. I've been in Ukraine this week. I came home yesterday. We traveled a lot in Ukraine, not at the front. We were about 500 kilometers from the front. We went from Krakow in Poland to Lviv, and via Lviv we went to the prison there outside Lviv, and then we went to the south to a conference place to do the training of the staff of the prison. Well, what you saw, what we met over there, also with the participants of the training, is the incredible complicated situation for people over there. First, there is of course the terrible and horrible situation at the front. It's a little bit like the First World War at Verdun, with those landmines. An incredible amount of people are killed and wounded because of those mines. There are some tons who there come only 30% of the people come back after the fight. So that's horrible. But it's the fighting is done by a very small amount of people comparing to the whole population of Ukraine. They come back home, those people, traumatized often, because they've seen horrible things, they've seen torturing, they've seen their buddies being killed. They feel guilty that they survived. They have been in a fighting situation, sometimes for a very long time, and they can't go to another gear when they come back in society, and they can't adapt to society. And what often happens is that there's human violence, or there's domestic violence and other violence by those people. They need to be helped, because they're traumatized. But what I also saw a lot was that it's also very hard for people who are not in the fight, the people who are not capable of fighting, of contributing to the war, not daring to do that. There are quite a few people who freeze in a situation like this. And it's also very human that there's a lot of people who are totally not fit, also mentally, to be in a war situation, in a fight at the front. They are so incredibly scared, or they're just, they don't want to leave their family, or they choose for their children and for their family, so that they try to, in all kinds of ways, try to avoid being in the war. Yeah? So they pay money to not go to the war, because it's still a corrupt country. Some of them, they fled the country, they go abroad, or they go to the professions or where they of jobs in which they are allowed not to go to war, like working in prison. When you work in the prison, you are free. You are not obliged to go to war because it's a necessary profession. But an emotion that you feel a lot is that even when people made the choice for this profession and they are not going into war, that they feel incredibly bad about it. And they feel very guilty because all the time they are confronted with people who go there, who get killed. In the group where we worked with, there was, for example, a lady, small children. Her husband was for the second time, he was mobilized and working, fighting at the war. And the chance that he comes back is very small, it's very small. So this lady had an incredible hard time, of course. It's incredible what she had. But also, there was a guy, he's a doctor, he's working at an NGO and also part of our project. And he has this thing where you bind legs off and there's a bleeding. I don't know the name. It's a sort of... when you have a major bleeding, you can bind your leg or arm off, like that. And he had it on him all the time, day and night, because he didn't want to get into a situation where it was needed and he wouldn't have it on him to help somebody and save a life. People were very tense. And I also was in a restaurant, and there were all people sitting and drinking. It was nice weather, and there were a few people with us who get very angry because they said, well, those are all people who had to be in the fight and in the war, but they're cowards. They didn't go to the front, and they are sitting here drinking, and look at them. I don't want to sit in the same space with them, that kind of reactions. Well, the way I look at this is that it's all very human. It's very human to try to avoid going into war. It's very brave when you go into the war, but the people who choose to go into war, because most of the people who are fighting at the front are volunteers, and those are often people who are capable of doing that, who have the skills and have the education, the training, and the character, the personality to be to do that, and not everybody can do that. A lot of people are really don't have the capacity to be at the front. So one of the leading people in the group we were working with said, well, it's better not to mobilize everybody. Well, you can mobilize everybody, but mobilize them for logistics and driving a car and cooking and, you know, everything what is needed to get people at the front. But the people you let fight, you really have to select them and train them, you know. And otherwise, things go wrong.
You know, you mentioned the people, mm-hmm. and I'm glad you mentioned the people, because our government leaders, and let me just pull this one. 508, you want to state your name, please?
Hi, Leona. Hi, Franz. It's Donna.
Hi, Donna.
Hi. I really love listening to you. I can't, you know, always do the things that you do, these experiences, but I really appreciate listening, and I'm so glad you're teaching it to other people, that Leona provides that venue and that others can learn from you. So, you know, I love learning from you. I now consider you one of my teachers.
Thank you.
You know, Donna, it's Franz is, he's very informative. And I was just saying earlier to him, you know, sometimes when you actually experience these, and I was going to mention the people that he's talking about, especially right now, he was speaking of also Ukraine. It's sad because it's the people, not only of Ukraine, but of every country that has to go through these wars that they don't want to happen. And it's our government leaders that need to come together, and they need to sit down and try to work things out to save the people, to save these people that are frightened, that are going through all these disasters for things that they themselves are not responsible for. So I'm glad that Franz is bringing this out in the open, because these type of things need to be mentioned. And Donna, don't slight yourself, because you're doing a lot of good, even for the mentally ill, behind those prison walls as well as in the communities. So you are just as important. And never forget that. Anyone that tries to help, anyone that tries to bring awareness and tries to resolve issues is important in my heart, in my eyes.
Thank you, Leona.
We agree, Leona. Yeah.
So, Franz, I'm going to let you finish what you were saying, and I'm sorry to interrupt.
The whole thing of our project is about creating special departments in Ukrainian prisons to treat veterans who come back with PTSS. That's the whole goal. And the whole problem of PTSS is a very familiar problem for the United States, of course. Yeah? Not only from the wars you were in, but also from things that happen to people, events that happen to people in society or in families, etc., etc. So damaged people, mentally damaged people, who not always, but often are violent towards themselves or others in their surroundings, until the moment that they find a way to find a way to deal with their pain and their injury, which is, by the way, often a moral injury. And that means that when you experience very bad things, very cruel things in a situation in which you know that you're doing the good thing and that you are making a difference, the damage is totally different than when you come back with feelings, I didn't do it all right. I made mistakes. I had to do more. I wasn't brave enough. Or, in general, that you find out you wanted to fight for your country, and what happened was that you were you lost your belief in the cause while fighting, and you experienced that it there was no use, and you have all kinds of feelings about the leaders of the army and of the country who put you in a very bad situation because of their interests, and just, you know, don't bother about your situation and who you are. That's all feelings like that, moral injury. That's a very mean feeling and a mean damaging awareness of people. So, and also very important is to say that doing something often is less damaging than not doing something, whatever the reason is that you are not involved and that you don't contribute. You know, that's a hard burden to have on your back. So what you see is we had an English trauma specialist with us who was a professor from King's Cross in King's College in London. She said a lot about trauma, and what you see is that Ukraine is going to get an enormous problem of thousands and thousands of people coming from war and being very damaged. So the Global Initiative on Psychiatry and the World Psychologist Organization, they are very, very busy to organize all kinds of help in communities, in the neighborhoods, locally, for people who come back and who are traumatized by the war, one way or the other. And my specific project is also with dead people, but it's directed to the prison. And well, what we do actually is with Dutch money, we do something about the building. We make some space for useful activities, for arts, for some gardening, for cooking, things like that, meaningful activities. Already, which is unique for Ukraine, on that department, the cell doors are open and people can walk around and are free to move within the premises. There are no uniformed staff also. There are people in their own clothes. And what we do during those days is a few things. We had a psychiatrist and a psychologist, and they gave some brief but very clear information about mental diseases and about psychopathology. But very soon they started to talk about the cases that the people were confronted with within in the prison, but also in their own lives and in their own neighborhood. So the people, the Ukrainian people, came with a lot of cases which we discussed about, which was very interesting. When I started, I had the keynote at the start, and the most important thing for me was to talk about human dignity, respect for human dignity. And I posed the question very, very soon, what is the difference between somebody inside the prison and somebody outside the prison? And in the group, there were two people, one had been 16 years in prison, it was a lady, and one had been 18 years in prison, in Ukrainian prison. They founded an NGO in Lviv, and they are working with sex workers, with former incarcerated people, with homeless people. And they also are part of our project, and they also work in the prison. And when I ask this question, I ask it to those people, because they had been inside and they had been outside. And they both started to tell their life stories one after the other. And then which was amazing. Also guards and nurses and psychiatrists who were their therapists, telling their life stories. And from all those stories, you could hear that we all have the same needs, and that we have totally different backgrounds, but we all want attention, we all want love, we all want to be seen, be heard, and sometimes some people, they experience a lot of violence in their youth. The lady had been a sex worker, she had been in prison for a long time, for 16 years, and she was, well, so incredibly strong and so amazing that she will be one of the most powerful partners in the whole project, you know? So what was very interesting, we had a very open and very active exchange with each other, which was amazing because this is the second time that I was there, and they already were, you know, the whole situation was really a safe place that we created with each other. People knew each other, people trusted us, we trusted the people, which was very nice. And also, next year we go three times more to Ukraine, to the rest of the training. And what was very nice was that we brought one guy with us. He worked in my prison about 30 years ago as a sports trainer, sport instructor for incarcerated people. And then he went to the police, and he, for many years now, he trains in the police, police officers for using violence and stuff like that. And he's a very big and but also a very sweet guy, very calm as well. And he did all kinds of physical things during the day with the group. And the first time when we were in Ukraine, we experienced that the people were very stressed. So everything that was physical, they had a hard time doing it because they were too stressed to let it go, to let it happen, you know, moving physically and touching each other and stuff like that. And this time it was a lot better, and he, for example, step by step did a haka from New Zealand with the group. New Zealand, you know that, the haka that you do before a sports game, a rugby game?
I'm not really a sports fan. Maybe Donna.
Well, the interesting thing, what they do is they are all together and they embrace each other to a big pile of men, and then they start screaming it out, you know. It's a sort of collective expression of love, you could see.
Oh.
So that's what he did with the group as well. And he did all kinds of in a very quiet tempo. He did all kinds of what he calls trust trainings and very simple exercises. Like one guy is standing on the table, pretty high, and he let himself fall backwards, and the other and has to trust that the others will catch him. You know, stuff like that.
Oh,
so
okay.
we also went to the woods, and we were imagining together that the woods was a prison, and we were talking about how the wood was shaped, used it as a metaphor of thinking about how the prison should be shaped in the most natural way. So that's the kind of things we did.
Can you share some of that, how the prison should be shaped?
Yes. Yes, very much. Very much. It's about, we are talking about in a wood, really need to protect the plants to not get into the shadow and die, you know, for example. We have to position people in a way that they all can have a little bit of light and grow and live, you know. That's how you shape a wood, for example. There has to be food. There has to be life must be possible. There has to be air. There has to be growth. It must be possible to grow in a wood. So I think apart from the exercise, I think going into a wood and be there with a group of people together, it makes a connection with nature. And when you connect to nature, you make connection with yourself, because we automatically, as human beings, we are part of nature. So it's a very nice thing to do when you want to connect and when you sincerely want to think about which choice you want to make in life.
I think nature is very important in every area of life. It's almost as though, you know, like when you take a walk, even, you know, when you do even the runs that they have, the marathons, things like that, I think it makes someone feel more, they feel better about themselves and they feel good. And that's when they're willing to focus more on their health. They're willing to focus more on the good things, not the evil, not the bad, you know, not the destructive.
That's why I always, in every prison where I come, all over the world, I'm always talking about gardens and growing food and cooking it as well. Mm-hmm.
I think that this is where they deprive incarcerated people from having any of that nature. And I can see being cautious about having the incarcerated individuals outside the prisons. But, you know, they have fences, and I know they allow them to go out for a portion of the time. But I think it's more important to, like you mentioned before, and I know others have had agricultural activities for the incarcerated, not only the agricultural part of it, but more outside activities for them to feel more inclusive of the people around them in their environment, those on the outside, the freedom. I think that's important as well.
Certainly. Well, we're talk a lot about also in those group yet a lot of young people who really want to have a very human approach, and they want to change things in the country as well. But you also have people of my age, of a little bit younger, who have been in the system their whole life and who have been in the process of every time that there was an incident, for example, they made a new security rule, you know? People are not allowed to do this or not allowed to do that. And when you do that in a system, then the end of it is that people are not allowed to do anything anymore, you know? They can't go outside, they can't take the stairs, they can't walk alone. I was really talking about that I wanted to install from Dutch money. I wanted to install a kitchen for the incarcerated people to cook. And there was a guy and he said, well, we have a magnetron, so we have a good project. And I said, yeah, magnetron, it's a lot nicer to have pans and casseroles and knives and forks and stuff. And he said, no, that's not allowed according to the rule, you know. So we have quite a lot of work to do. And, well, the most important thing is that in every prison in the world, you have the risk that you start seeing people just as a danger, you know, as crazy people who are dangerous and who want to harm other people. And when you do that, you can't allow anything anymore. There's no trust. And what you get is a lot of violence and a lot of misery. And as soon as you decide to realize that the group that is there in that prison is very well capable of having all the stuff to be able to cook, you know, then you get a total different atmosphere. You get an atmosphere which is a lot safer. Okay? And of course, when somebody is totally disturbed or has a nervous breakdown or something then like that, you have to secure him to not harm others or himself. Of course, he has to do that. But I think that's very situational. And that's one of the things that our sports trainer for police also showed. And the next time we're going to exercise that in the prison itself, in the cells, you're going to exercise how you can, if necessary, for the security, you have to use violence, how you can do that in a loving way, in a way that's not sadistic, doesn't harm people, and that's, you know, it's something you have to learn. Also, physically, you have to train to be able to do it very calm.
I'd like to ask your thoughts on this. You mentioned calm. You know, I used to give like exercise classes to these people, the elderly, in a community room. And mm-hmm. there was a woman, she had a form of Parkinson's. Her hands would really shake. And I would do like exercise, have them do exercises sitting in their chairs. But one day I just knelt down beside this woman. Her hands were shaking. I knelt down beside her and I put her hand on her lap. And I started massaging her hand and talking quietly to her. And everything stopped. And but that's one example of how you can how people that have these disabilities can function a little bit better. I worked for May Institute at one time. May Institute works with children, with autistic children and adults. And I used to sit down and talk with them. I would talk to them like they were normal, which they are normal with a disability, a slight, but they seem to act so different. Now, I was wondering if in the prisons, and I'm always saying they should defund the prisons until we see positive interaction between the prison officials and correctional officers and the prisoners, the incarcerated. If they were to show positive behaviors, the incarcerated, then I think that it would be helpful to take those who are showing positive behavior and every now and then to take them out, to let them go out of the prison with, of course, with supervision with the staff. But I think they should show some kind of, they should get some kind of initiative for the positive behaviors that go on, not only in the penal system, but also in these institutions, these like May Institution, like these places that have these people with disabilities.
Yeah.
I think treating people, as you said before, and as Donna and other people have said, if we treat them a little bit more humane, I think we'll see a lot more positive interaction, and I think we can actually see some positive rehabilitation, wherever it may be.
I couldn't have formulated it better than you did, Leona. This is what needs to happen, I'm sure. I'm sure.
There are so many. I'm sad, but there are so many people that if given the chance, they could show positive behaviors, but by depriving them of this. You know, I took care of a little boy one time. He had, well, his mother said he had autism, but I didn't see it in him. His name was Connor, and Connor had the most beautiful blue eyes and blonde hair. He was just adorable. He was like 4 years old, 5 years old. But she made him feel, because she was opening her own autistic facility, she was trying to make him seem like he was much worse than he was, so that she could say with her facility that this is what happens. They improve themselves. But he was not demonstrating any form of autism. He wasn't. Mm-hmm. And it's sad because people try to sometimes make people look worse so they can justify what they're doing, or they can justify the funding. And I think that happens a lot in the penal system with prisons across the country. They in the media reporting one-sided stories is helping them to justify something that should not be in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very, very, very clear, very sure. Yeah, it starts with us somehow looking at people as if they are not like us, you know? That's how it starts. And it becomes a little bit evil when people do that because of a financial or organizational interest. That makes it ugly, you know, when people do that. But basically, it seems very hard for people to not look in a judging way to others. I can give you a few examples. When I say that I've been incarcerated, for example, on a birthday party or in the street or in the pub or whatever, it really shapes the view of everybody on me. And that won't change until I die, you know. It will last for 20, 30 years. This is a guy who has been in prison. Even when I say to, I'm in a hiking club or in those kinds of environments, when I start saying that I have been a prison warden, people always are reacting on that. And having been a prison warden, people have a certain image of people who do that kind of jobs, and they look at me that way, while having been a prison warden is just one aspect of my life, you know? And there are a lot of other aspects. So the whole judging of people is incredible. And this kid, this beautiful kid where you work with, he is seen as a probably wrong diagnosis that they put on him. And he isn't seen at all for who he is. And I'm just very happy that you met him and that you occupied yourself of him, because I think people like you working with a guy like that, a boy like that, make the difference.
Well, it's like with you, it's almost like we know there's a lot of ineffective doctors operating on people. And some people survive and others don't. Well, it's the same way with wardens, commissioners. You know, you put your heart into your work. You're not just doing it because you want to be powerful and you want to be in, you know, the one that makes these great decisions over these people. You treat these people human, and this is what's needed. So it's no matter who it is, it could be a warden, it could be a correctional. There's good correctional officers, there's good prison officials, but there's those that are totally opposite. They're violent, they're criminal like themselves. And this is why, listening to you, I think people see that you're a very fair person. They can see where progress would be made in the work that you do. Whereas in other areas, they're looking at these other wardens as being either non-caring or just as corrupt as some of their employees.
Well, so it's also a little bit when you're in the position of a warden or a politician, for example, or somebody with influence, with other influence, the people who work for you, for example, the guards, we all know that when the context in the prison is not okay and when there's not a good example and when people are... you try to use their negative, their dark side to do the job, for example, out of fear, out of aggression, out of feeling power, then you get a very bad prison. But then you manage to tell people inside the prison and show them that they're positive, that they can work with their positive side, the side that they want to use to bring their children up or to treat their wives or stuff like that. Then you get a total different prison. I had one guy, I was in the prison in Ukraine last week, and there was one young guy, and I immediately saw him because he was had an open face and he was very energetic. You saw him move energetic, and I said, well, show me the other part of the building. And then he met an incarcerated guy who came out of his cell, and they spoke for a while. And what happened was that this guy, he was totally depressive, this incarcerated guy. He had been in his cell for months. And this guard, this young guard, he had found out that the guy was actually very intelligent. And the guy dreamt of going to work abroad and things like that. And he stimulated him to do an English course. He said, well, what you have to do is to learn English, and then when you use your time in prison to do that, you can really use it to realize your dreams and stuff like that. And the guy started to learn English. The young guy, he thought it was very normal, and he didn't even realize that he made a difference to that guy. He just did what his heart gave him in. Yeah? But I use it as a big example in the group. Because approaching it that way really makes a difference. And I said, well, this guy is working in the way that really makes a difference between night and day, you know?
Exactly. It's obvious. In everything that you say and everything that you've been talking about, even with Dave Van Veen, the gentleman that you brought on the show that wrote the book with Marika, the way he was talking, it's almost like one comes out very positive, but then we see a lot of people coming out of prisons and they feel bitter. They feel as though, you know, they were, I don't know, violated in so many ways and didn't have an opportunity. We just want to see people that are going into prison being treated, as you say, humanely. We want to see them getting the appropriate programs and rehabilitative activities in place. And I think, yep. I'm going back to nature again. There was a, and he's still on the run, there was a prisoner in Pennsylvania that escaped. And it's been over a week now. They haven't found him, but he's in the same state. But they said somebody must know that they haven't been able to locate him. They say now that they feel that somebody's been helping him. There are people out in the communities, I hate to say it. Well, I don't hate to say it, but they actually understand what a lot of these people are going through. And they probably have taken some time out to help wherever they can to help some incarcerated people that have gotten out. There was a, and I know Donna probably will remember this, not too long ago, I'd say a couple of years back, there was a prison, she was a staff, an employee of the Department of Corrections, and she fell in love with one of the prisoners. And apparently she helped him to escape. They found him. But they found them both. But when they found them, she ended up dying, and he ended up going back to prison. I believe she shot herself. She killed herself, or the people looking for them shot her. But it goes to show you that people inside see the good in some of those that are incarcerated. And that's the way society needs to look at it, too, instead of stereotyping. They need to look at these individuals in prison who are trying to do the right things. And unfortunately, many of them are being deprived that opportunity because they're targeted by prison officials or by guards. Mm-hmm. They're targeted, they're prevented from doing anything positive because these people want them to look bad when they either go up for parole or look bad to society to make them look worse than they are.
Yeah.
So a lot needs to be done in those areas as well.
Sure about that. Sure about that.
And Donna, if you have anything to add to all of this, please feel free to. Okay, she may be on mute. So, Franz.
Hi, Leona. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, okay. Can I ask a question to Leona?
Yes, please.
I know that Leona has been. Let me first start to say that I was very impressed by the plans that are policy plans that are made about the prison system in your state. I got this points that they want to improve in the juridical system in your state, isn't it?
Mm. You know, I want to say something, Franz. Someone on Facebook, on social media, mentioned an individual that was incarcerated. He was in a cell, and she said that her son was placed in the same cell with this individual for that week. And her son had told her when he went in that cell that the other prisoner got up on the top of his bunk, shivering, scared, very scared, and got up on the top of his bunk and was kind of like curled in the corner. And she was saying how, because we were talking about mental illnesses, but I said, it sounds to me like it was a lot more than a mental illness. It sounds to me as though he was violated. And it's sad because these things are going on in the prisons around the country. And nobody is picking up on these things or no one is doing anything about it. And I think that it's very, very unfortunate. It's very sad that there are people in prison that no one knows anything about. They have no family. They have no one that's actually connecting with them. And they're afraid to speak out about what's going on with them in those prisons. And this is very unfortunate because I contribute a lot of that to the suicides that take place in the United States prisons. And it really infuriates me that there are not more lawyers or more advocates out in the communities trying to, even our legislative members, trying to find out more about these types of individuals behind those prison walls that have been forgotten and that have been violated.
What I received is 6 ways that DOG is working towards criminal justice reform.
Exactly.
And I had, it is a 6-point plan. And they're talking about raising the standards of federal law enforcement agencies, promoting new practices in law enforcement, response to behavioral or mental health crisis, criteria for improving condition of confinement for prisoners, and another few points. I was very impressed by that. And I think it was very nice.
You have connections with the United Nations, and a lot of people in this country have spoken about the possibility of contacting the United Nations and having them really look into the United States prisons. But what you're reading right now with the Department of Justice, this would be a good opportunity for people like yourself in other countries to contact the Department of Justice and just let them know, help them to find ways to improve their penal system. Because your work is so valuable, Franz. I'm going to tell you, your work is so valuable. Sometimes I believe that they are hearing your message and hearing the messages or seeing what's going on in other countries. And now they're able to start focusing more on some of those issues.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so important for you to be on the shows.
And also, we are all together. It's not the United States is a total different country comparing to the Netherlands or Norway or other countries in Western Europe. But at the same time, you come from other countries, people in the United States, and the base of the United States comes from Western Europe and Africa and later China and, you know, from all over the world. And the issue of dealing with people who commit crimes is something we have to, and the inequality between peoples in societies is a common problem. It's a problem that we have to face together internationally, I think.
Yes.
There is no difference between a young boy incarcerated in a juvenile institution in harsh circumstances in the United States as the same boy who has the Dutch nationality incarcerated in the Netherlands, you know. Those boys are all our children, and we all have to feel responsible for all the children in the world, I think. So that's one of the reasons that I'm very curious about. When I was in Ukraine, there was a meeting, and Donna was part of that, people of several countries. And I'm very curious to ask Donna how the meeting was and where it was about.
Donna, did you hear his question?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah, it was amazing. I've already passed on a lot of the information to some of the institutions, penal institutions. What I took away, you're talking about this latest international meeting, Franz?
Yes, yes.
Yes. So, you know, the fact that children honored and they have rights and, you know, to their parental communications and family unification, which is something I very strongly am advocating for. And, you know, by doing programs for children and working to keep them connected with incarcerated parents, they're preventing future traumas, future mental illnesses, future stress disorders. I was very, very impressed. It's such important work. And I love, Franz, how you said, you know, they're all our children, the children of the world. That's awesome. Yeah. And I feel like, you know, with the population I work with, the families and the mentally ill who are incarcerated, when one is hurt, we all hurt.
Yes.
You know, it's amazing the connection that the family members of Bridgewater State Hospital have, because it's so true. When one of our family members is hurting because, you know, their son or their brother or, you know, their loved one is struggling, we hurt for them. It's such an amazing thing. And, you know, on the other hand, when we're doing something good, you know, we all celebrate that. We currently have collected Fast and Furious. People, just family members, want to donate. And we're finding ways to help our population by maybe subscriptions for the library, doing a special Saturday night snack because they're so bored. We're pushing for more weekend activities. You know, just that there's a little bit of joy and satisfaction when we can make life better for our population. And, you know, so that's the correlation I see between these people working to help children and their incarcerated family members, as well as, you know, the family members of my population working to make the lives of all the patients better.
Yeah.
They just, you know, they could put money, and they do, of course, into the canteens. We're able to purchase and order a meal in and have that in the visitor rooms, something we fought for. But we know that, as you mentioned, Franz, you know, and Leona, there are prisoners, incarcerated persons who have no one to have their back. And so we as a body, you know, the Bridgewater State Hospital family members, we are fighting for all of those patients. We're trying to do things that benefit the whole population, all of the patients, not just our own. And that's, you know, that's what's impressive, and that's what's needed in this world.
Yes.
Fantastic. Yeah, my friend Hank was at the meeting as well. Huh? Hank?
Yes. I loved when he spoke up, and I'm anxious to learn more and hear more from him.
He's an amazing guy. He's an amazing guy. Yeah.
Yes. I could see his outgoing personality, and, you know, I see he has a lot to share, and I think, you know, he had asked on the email, the group email, you know, if he could talk a little bit about what he does next meeting, so I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, I'll be there then, too, as well.
Oh, great.
I love it.
That's great.
I love it. I love hearing what you all are doing, because this is just, I wish more people would join you in what you're, the activities that you're doing to make things better for human beings, whether they're behind the walls or wherever they are, coming together like you have all been coming together has been, I've been enjoying listening to you both talk and those that you have brought on as well.
And you know, Leona, we recently got a new administration because the previous administration, frankly, just didn't give a darn. And, you know, these people who are now in place really do want to help the families. And we had a fabulous art class led by myself. I made it a lot of fun. I did a fun slide presentation on Mona Lisa, and then we did a corresponding art project. But it was one of the patients' birthday. And I asked if at all possible if the, you know, the assistant administration could bring a cake. She ended up bringing cupcakes out of her own pocket. And she was told, well, you shouldn't do that because you can't favor one person. But what it did was that whole room, you know, maybe their birthday wasn't, the other patients, their birthday wasn't getting celebrated, but they were so joyful to sing to this one patient. And I've seen this patient just folded into himself at times and so depressed, and you can see the illness. And, you know, to edify him and let him know of his utmost importance, it was so joyful. So when we can get administrations and people who run these facilities to have a modicum of compassion and to work with the families, you know, so that the families aren't torn apart and worried and anxious about their well-being, then that's a good thing. And just one other thing, because Leona brought up this patient who's on the run in Pennsylvania. And at first the mother, you know, her first instinct, or at least she was encouraged to, like, make a formal announcement to have him turn himself in. And days later, she knows of the harms inside some of these prisons and what might happen to him for escaping. And she actually came out and verbalized that, you know, to her son in a public message. He's still on the run, but she said, you know, it's better if you die than if you go there and suffer and, you know, are harmed and then die in prison. She'd rather see him die on the spot, which is crazy. But, you know, to know what he's going to be up against when he's captured, you know, must frighten her for her to make that, you know, very dramatic statement.
You know, Donna, I want to say something to that, Fran, because there have been times, I'm going to say this, not only that mother, but many of us have looked for the day that it would finally end, especially when they're serving life sentencing or life without, or even on death row. Let it be done right away so that the suffering can stop, not only for those who are incarcerated, but for their loved ones who are on the outside fighting for them. We have to look at what it's doing to families. And people that escape, I don't know why they escape, and I don't know why they would want to, because in this day and age, no one can escape and not be caught at some point in time. They have cameras all over the place, in trees. They have them on buildings. This young man will eventually be caught. And as you said, his mother probably is concerned about him going back to prison and having to spend the rest of his life being brutalized by the staff. And this is why it's so important, Franz, for you to be on, for Donna to be on, and for so many others that have come on to talk about these things, because it's happening. And I get sick and tired of having these people in government talk about how these men need more training, the staff need more training. It's not about the staff needing more training. It's about the heart. It's about It's about the same kind of heart that you have, Franz, that Donna has, that Dave has, that Marika has, that all of these other people that come on the show have. It doesn't need to be a lot of training. It needs to be a lot more compassion and mercy and forgiveness and understanding. And these are things that people in this country especially have no knowledge of because they're so bent on hatred and power and greed and corruption. No one would have to escape if they were being treated properly, if they were getting the programs that they need to help them to rehabilitate. There would be no reason for them to escape. And that's my theory.
Mm-hmm.
It is, in a sense, it's like we're all incarcerated, Leona. The family members, in a sense, are incarcerated in a world of anxiety and worry and, you know, knowing what the system of incarceration can be. But on the other hand, you know, we need people like Franz Dow running our prisons, and we
exactly.
need the right people. I think of Superintendent David Tuttle of Worcester County Jail, and he actually bought a kitchen. Franz, you were talking about, you know, a kitchen at the importance. So a school was closing down, the Salter School or College, kind of a combination, not quite an accredited college, but a long-standing school in Worcester, Massachusetts. And he went in and he purchased that kitchen. And I actually have been to two events at the Worcester County Jail because that's part of my work with FEMI, is working with some of the jails and prisons. And I had two meals, you know, created by these inmates. And they were wonderful. And we actually got to meet one of the, you know, the chefs. And I thanked him for such a lovely, lovely spread. And also the other thing that David Tuttle did was that a company who repairs RVs, recreational vehicles, needed help, and they can't get enough help. So they went to him and they said, you know, David, if you buy a recreational vehicle, and we'll come in and train some of your inmates, and when they come home, we'll hire them. And he went out and bought that recreational vehicle. And that's also thanks to, you know, the sheriff who's in charge of the superintendent, because the sheriff, you know, likes the fact that his superintendent is doing, you know, humane work for those inmates.
Interesting. Yeah, but What I always experience when you're talking, Donna, is that you see the good in everything and everybody. Despite the fact that we live in a very broken and injustice world, you're always directed to that. And I think that's a very powerful characteristic of you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
I can really see that it makes a difference when you walk around in that system and doing all kinds of things and meeting people, that it's really inspires and supports people to do the right thing. You know?
Thank you. I'm working on that.
Can I ask a very impolite question?
Of course.
What's your age?
I actually am 73 years young.
73.
I feel like I'm 30, but I'm 73 chronologically.
Well, actually, you sound like 25, but well, there's also something else. You know, there are not very many men in this world who would like to hurt their mothers, you know? Most of the people I know, also the incarcerated people, they admire their own mother.
My mother used to have a saying that when you meet a man that treats his mother very well, you're going to meet a good husband.
Mm-hmm.
Because because that's what it, if they're going to take care of their mother and love their mother and be there for their mother, they're going to be there for their wife as well. And I'm sure the same thing happens with the male too. I mean, with the female too. If they treat their fathers right and treat their mothers right, they'll be a good wife.
Yeah, very true, very true. But I know a few older ladies in the Netherlands. We have Rosaline. She is already over 80 years old, and she is a volunteer in prisons since 60 years. She's
wow.
visiting prisoners inside the prison, and she met them in groups in my prison as well. Incredibly modest and sweet lady she is. And I have a story about her. In the Netherlands, we didn't have email for families of prisoners. They couldn't email their loved ones inside. And I was, as a prison governor, I was fighting for that. And what happened was that certain people on the Department of Justice, they tried to avoid, they did block me. You know? They undermined my activities. They said, well, because of the computers and security of the networks and, you know, all kinds of what I now can say bullshit that they did just to avoid me letting the family email their loved ones. Well, it was Rosaline. She said, well, Franz, we're going to make a plan. I put a printer on my table in my house. All these loved ones can do their email to me. I print it all out, I put it in an envelope, and I bring it to the prison. And in the middle of a winter, for months, snow and very sleep, roads and stuff like that, she was already far over 70 with her bike and bags at her stir, you know. She came with these big bags with envelopes to bring to the prison. And we made photos of that, and I wrote a letter with these photos to the minister. And then he said, well, Franz, you can do it in your prison. You can do a tryout. Huh? She doesn't have to carry those bags anymore. We do it by computer. And when it works, we can do it for the whole country. So what happened was... we implemented it in my prison, and of course it went very well. It was a real success. And then they said, well, every warden who wants it in his prison can have it. So we spread it to all the prisons in the Netherlands. That's one example of a pilot, this is. And 10 years later, 10 years after we implemented this, and it's only 2 years ago, or 1.5 years ago, because of big drugs criminals who were suspected of having used the email servers for their criminality, they stopped the whole service again. You know, so today, again, people can't email their loved ones in prison. So what it shows, in my opinion, is in the first time that it's very well possible, if you really want it, to make a change by fighting for space to try things out and to do a pilot. Hmm? It's a good way to convince everybody, especially when it works in practice, when you show the process. But it's also this example also shows a very other sad thing, and that is that when politicians, because it's about politicians, that, politics, that they stop this email service, that when the wind in the country blows in the suppresses for direction, you know, it can all, you know, go away again as well, you know.
Mm.
I've seen that a lot in my career as well, that, you know, it's you have periods when there is more eye for humanity and for the human dignity and human measure, and there are periods who are more repressive. It goes up and it goes down all the time. Do you recognize this in the United States as well?
Donna?
Yeah, that's a hard question. I do see that, you know, if a small, I think Franz did mention this earlier, that, you know, security can get tighter and tighter. If someone breaks the rules, then everyone suffers for it. It was kind of like in school, you know, if you, somebody did something amiss, a school child, the whole class had to stay afterward. You know, so I do see that that does happen. I've seen it happen, you know, at Bridgewater State Hospital. They'll give it a try. And if, you know, just 1%, you know, goes wrong, then everybody suffers for it. And it gets stricter and stricter. And
yeah.
You know, just tough on families and tough on the inmates.
Yeah, very true.
I think it is very tough on the prisoners, because they're being penalized for the actions of another prisoner or other prisoners. Every time somebody, even with gang members, when they get in fights, it should be, that's why I say they should have gang members in separate prisons, because when they get into fights, which is probably often the gang rivals, all the prisoners have to suffer for something they're not a part of. And it happens with individual prisoners too. If something breaks out on a block, all the people on that block suffer, and it shouldn't be. There's a lot of people that are not fighters. They don't want to fight. You know, they want to serve their time without incident. And these things happen, and all of a sudden they're being penalized for someone else's, you know, actions.
Yeah. And in the United States, there have been some successful programs for the gang members, isn't it?
You know, I heard, I'm not sure, but I heard there was a place somewhere in Connecticut where if gang rivals or gang members want to disassociate themselves from their gangs, that they will send them. But I don't know where these places are. I guess they, you know, they're in discretion. I don't know. I don't think that they let people know where these facilities are. But they do have facilities for people that want to leave the gangs that they are involved with.
Yeah.
I heard that years ago.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Donna.
Oh, I had a question. It was really interesting. My daughter, you know, has a little bit of interest because of what I'm doing, and because, you know, her nephew, my grandson, is at Bridgewater State Hospital. Has a little bit of interest in, you know, what's happening in the prisons, et cetera. So she ended up listening to a podcast of a program or a documentary, maybe, and it was a sheriff who was in Texas or somebody who was involved in the prison system. And she told me, Mom, they call them by their first name, and they have the prisoners, you know, decide, be self-sufficient in doing these programs. And I thought, that sounds like Franz. Did he train somebody in Texas? So that's my question. Did you train somebody in Texas?
Well, I did some speeches in Texas, and I met some wardens, but I don't think I know.
It was a warden, and she said he, you know, he looked like a, well, she described him, she's not really a Trump fan, she described him, you know, I thought he was going to be this Trump Republican, you know, but she said he was really, you know, amazing in his innovation, and I think you had that influence, because my jaw dropped. Everything she was telling me sounded like Franz. I says, I think Franz had some influence on this warden.
I think Franz has influence on everybody.
Now, when your daughter can find his name, it would be very interesting. Then I try to contact
him. She's gonna try to find it for me. You know, so that was great.
I want to say something about it. What I see in every country, where I've been, including the United States, that it can be very good in certain places and very human, and sometimes 50 miles or 100 miles further in the same country, you see very bad examples. And especially in the United States, where I think sheriffs are voted for by the people, isn't it? They're voted, they're chosen.
That's correct, yes.
Well, when you have a community in which there's a different atmosphere, you know, amongst the people in the community.
Exactly.
Then a guy like this can get sheriff, and he can really make a difference. And I can tell you, I'm a pretty big guy myself, you know, so I'm also looking like somebody who could do bad things to other people. But you know, when you are just the kind of guy who has learned in his life that you don't need to be tough, and that it's also very strong and very powerful to be vulnerable and to show your soft side to your first to your wife and to your family, of course, but also to in your job and to your society. When it's a guy like that, and I'm sure there are a lot of guys like that even in Texas, then you can have a very good and community which is capable of, when people get in trouble, when violence happens, then together, especially with a sheriff like that, they can they manage to restore the situation and make recovery possible for everybody.
You know, Franz, can I respond to that? Years ago when I was in high school, we had a teacher, and he was a big teacher. And when we first started the class, he went over to some of the kids, the guys, and one of them was acting out. And so he put him up against the wall, and he put his hands around his neck. And he said, "I had your father in my classroom before." But this teacher, he would do things smiling, but you could tell he was getting angry because his face would get as red as a beet. And he would say, "I had your father in my class before, and you can ask your father how I am." And he said, "I can be the nicest man, I can be the nicest teacher you'll have, and I can be your worst enemy." And that kid turned, he sat down, and no one ever gave that teacher a problem after that.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I didn't be violent. I never used violence since, well, probably 30 years or so towards people, physical violence. I don't need to do that. But I remember when I started to work in the Juvenile Institute, which guys up to 18 years who fought a lot with each other, who wanted to test us out as well, the staff of the institution. I remember that one time there was a big guy, he was a lot taller than me. He said, "Well, you know, you're not going to get me to your cell, to my cell." And well, me, myself, I was 20 years old. He was 18, and he was a lot bigger than me. And he said, and I was alone in the department, so there were no colleagues. I, in those days, you really had to get them in their cells alone in those days. So turned out into a big fight between him and me. And which was really, you know, a big test as well. I'm sure that when I lost, I could have looked for another job, you know. So I managed to put him in his cell, and he draw a knife, and I kicked the knife out of his hand, and it was a terrible situation in a way. And he also got a black eye as well, the guy. So the next day, I really felt like I don't want to be in a situation like this ever again, you know. The person that I was during that fight is not the person that I like, you know. So I decided not to do that anymore and to find other ways to resolve those kinds of situations. And I must say that I managed to do that. I never went into a situation like that. And at the same time, the fact that that I did that with this guy, because he was called the king of the institution, and he did a lot of harm to other boys who were there. He was beating them up and stuff. The fact that I had this fight also stated my authority. So they never tried it again also. You know?
But you did it justifiably, because, as you mentioned, he was not only bigger than you, but he was doing things to others as well. So it wasn't as though you were practicing this on a regular basis. I can understand when in authority, someone has to do something drastic to get to get things under control. Now, when I talk about the corruption and the activities of the prison guards and officials in this country, I talk about it being done on a regular basis, and I talk about it being done by people who really don't care, who are just punks, as I call them, or bullies or cowards. But in your case, what you're describing perhaps is necessary, and I agree that this is necessary at times. It doesn't need to be an ongoing action on your part or anyone else's part, but you felt bad about it.
I never did it again, but this is not the end of the story.
You felt bad about it, but at the same time, it was something at that time you felt you needed to do. And it wasn't with somebody that wasn't doing anything. When people do things like that with incarcerated individuals that are doing nothing wrong, that are just trying to do serve their time without incident, when people in power do something to them and make it difficult for them, for no reason at all other than they've been targeted. But when prisoners act out, in the case that you're talking about, it was necessary because he was bigger than you. You know, it's not like out in the street when people are being shot down.
I resolved it in a total different way in other situations. I didn't need to go as far as I did then. But the story is not finished yet, because it's pretty funny, because many years later, I lived in Utrecht, and with my wife, and my daughter was born, and she was sleeping upstairs. I was alone at home. And the night before, the neighbor had said, "Well, there has been somebody at your door, and it didn't look safe at all. It was a big guy on a motorcycle. He was from one of those motor clubs, Hell's Angel or something like that, and he was looking for you. And well, he said he will come back today, and if you have a problem, I will watch you, and you can give me a sign, and then I will call the police or something like that." So the doorbell rang, and there was this huge guy with his motorbike and his Hell's Angel jacket on, was standing in front of me, and I recognized the guy that I had fought with.
Oh, geez.
He was standing in front of me, and he said, "Hello, friends. I come here to tell you that I'm doing very well and to thank you." So I invited him in the house, and he told me that where he was brought up, he was, you know, nobody could stop him, even his father. He beat his father up, was invalid. I was the first and only person with the guts to stop him and to really tell him, use my fist in those days, here is the line, you can't get over that, you know? And he said that was very important for me. He said, and today I have a very nice shop in bicycles, in motorcycles, in VA. I have a wife, I have two children, we have a very happy life. And I just brought you this to thank you. And he had a big bottle of whiskey he put on my table. And then he shook my hand and he said, well, now I take my motorcycle because I have to be home in time for dinner. So thank you very much. And then he left.
Wow. And that was from a Hell's Angel. That's from a Hell's Angels. My goodness gracious. We have them in the United States.
Yeah, we have them in the Netherlands too. And
it goes to show you that, you know, a lot of times kids being brought up with the wrong morals are seeking discipline as you talk about it. They're seeking it. And this man was appreciative of what you did.
Yeah, because he also very much knew that I didn't do it with a sadistic motive or to hurt him, you know. From both of us, it was a sincere situation. We just had to have this clash, you know.
Mm.
And we fought it out. And after that, there was no... because he didn't left the institutions. I worked with him for quite a while after that as well. So... it was when the meeting between you and an incarcerated people, for example, is sincere, and when you're honest and you don't tell stories, you know, then they respect you also, you know. They see you're working, if you're a mean person or want to hurt them or not.
Well, Franz, I want to say, I know we've kept you up too late and we're going overtime now, but I want to thank you again for coming on. Franz will be on with us next Wednesday as well. I just want to say, Franz, right now, listening to you throughout these weeks, I've learned a lot. I've learned a lot that can be applied to our penal system, to the prisons in the United States of America. And I just hope and pray that legislative members and also even prison wardens and commissioners in the United States will try to learn something from you, because you have been in all areas of criminal justice and you have been showing your strong points as well as your weaker points, but you have been showing your successes, and that's what's needed around the world today. So I thank you so much for coming on. And Donna, I thank you for joining in every time, because you too have been doing a lot of good in the United States right now with what you're doing. And the mentally ill is something that needs to be looked at very closely in the penal system, as well as those who have addictions. I want to thank you too, Franz, for bringing on Dave Van Beem and also Marika Shine Gills. I finally learned how to pronounce her name thanks to her, but they were really a blessing as well. Tomorrow we will have on with us at 1 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time, Mariam Jacobs, psychosocial therapist from the Netherlands and also author of the book Suspended Values in Concentration Camps and Prisons, Comparing the Prisons and Concentration Camps in the U.S. So I want to thank you for coming on. I appreciate it.
Speaking my warm greetings to her.
I will, Franz. And as I said, I'd like to send you invitations when anyone is coming on from the Netherlands. I'd like to send all of them invitations in case they want to join as well, join the show. I'll tell you, the Netherlands may be a smaller entity, to the U.S., but they're successful, as well as Norway and others. And I appreciate, and I know others appreciate it. Every time you come on, you're giving some positive feedback. You're teaching us a lot. And people in this country, hopefully, will take example and will apply it to their laws and their policies in the United States around the penal system. And thank you for updating us on the Ukraine as well, Franz, because those countries, as I say, I hope and pray that they will try to negotiate so that not many more innocent lives will be wasted as well.
I hope so. Thank you.
Donna, do you have any last-minute statements?
Nope. I just want to say thank you to both of you. I love learning. I hope to continue learning from both of you.
And we look forward to learning from you as well, Donna. You're pretty active lately yourself, and this is great. So I thank you both for coming on. Franz, again, thank you so, so much.
Thank you. See you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.